Hello and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 376. This week the questions are taken from guide 444 on the Arethusa class cruisers of World War I, the Wednesday video with Sal on US Navy logistics in 42 to 45, and a Friday video on carrier aircraft range and what that actually means. Scott Mason asks, if the Bismarcks and Königsbergs are such bad designs, what would you consider to be the best design ships that the Germans built from the two world wars? So if we restrict ourselves to surface warships, I mean, to be honest, if I was going to go, obviously as an engineer, purely by efficiency and to a certain degree aesthetics, this list would be extremely heavily dominated by the World War I Imperial German Navy, because while in the run-up to World War I, they, to a certain extent, had some areas to catch up in, like gun elevation and propulsion systems, overall, the High Seas Fleet was able to churn out designs that were competitive with what you might define as the average ship of the time, and often better than quite a few. I usually point to the Der Flinger class as a good example of this. Now, the interesting thing you've got to remember when you're comparing the Der Flingers is that in terms of displacement, you need to compare them with the Lions, that being Lion and Princess Royal, which are themselves about 3 years earlier than the Der Flingers. The exact contemporary of the Der Flingers is Tiger, but she's about 2,000 tons heavier. But nonetheless, the Der Flingers are a really good example of a good, solid German design. They're well protected. They've got a decent armament that's laid out sensibly, and they're reasonably quick. Now, is the Der Flinger the ideal battlecruiser design? I would argue probably not. I mean, the aesthetics of the massive tripod mast they stuck on later on, that's debatable. There's obviously a good reason why it was done. It still made the ships look a lot uglier than where they were at launch, but that's pure aesthetics. In terms of the design itself, if I was designing the Der Flinger class, I think there could be an argument made for reducing the overall area of armor coverage, not reducing the thickness, but concentrating the protection. And that might then buy you enough spare weight to do one of two things, or possibly a little bit of both. Either a slight boost to true speed as opposed to artificial trial speed, or a slightly higher elevating and maybe somewhat larger main armament, i.e. bigger than 12-inch guns. And that would make an almost ideal battlecruiser. Now, the thing is, with any capital ship design, you can point to things that you might do slightly differently. That's what I would do slightly differently with the Der Flingers. The other thing related to that, which would be important, even if you weren't going to upgrade the actual armament of the Der Flingers, would be to upgrade, with the saved weight, upgrade the actual armor on the turrets, because it's only fractionally thicker than the armor that you'll find on the British battlecruisers. But the key difference is, of course, when the fuses work, the British battlecruisers are flinging much larger shells at you, generally speaking. And you see that turrets getting knocked out by hits is a persistent issue with the German battlecruisers at Jutland. So, yeah, if I was revising the Der Flinger design by concentrating the armor protection on the belt and deck somewhat, my first priority would be probably at least a couple more inches on the turrets, then looking at maybe making the guns a little bit larger, as well as increasing their elevation. Maybe increasing their elevation should go joint with the increasing of the armor, and then look at maybe boosting true speed a little bit. But the Der Flingers are still a really good, efficient design for what they are. And if we switch over to World War II, the Elbing class, or the Type 39 torpedo boats, they're actually surprisingly good. They're a bit overgrown for torpedo boats, but they're actually coming in, as I pointed out a few times before, at kind of the displacement of a small destroyer, or at least an escort destroyer or destroyer escort, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on. They're fairly capable designs for closer range escort missions. They're far more efficient than the massive overblown designs that compose the majority of the German destroyer fleet, and they'd be quicker and faster to build. So in my opinion, if the Germans had designed something like a Type 39, but maybe back in the early 1930s, they could have mass produced them and had a lot more quote-unquote destroyers available for their various escapades in Norway and the Baltic and the North Sea, etc. And if you wanted a bigger destroyer design, perhaps for going up into further waters or rougher waters, the Elbing design in and of itself is relatively solid. You could upscale it to maybe a 1600, 1800 ton design and give it slightly heavier guns. And, you know, keep the overall layout, just upgrade the gun size and so forth, and maybe have quad launchers instead of triples. And that would be a perfectly serviceable and, again, pretty mass-producible destroyer. So it's a really good solid design that could have been the basis of a lot of other good solid designs, but unfortunately the Germans ended up going with destroyers that displaced as much as some World War I-era cruisers and didn't really get a huge return on their investment for that. And as you know, I'm also quite partial to the Scharnhorst class. Again, it has its flaws, primarily around sea keeping up front, even with the Atlantic bow. But in terms of an efficient design, sort of, you know, how much you get per ton, especially if they'd gone with the option of putting twin 15s on instead, the Scharnhorsts are miles more efficient a design than the Bismarcks. So yeah, the Germans definitely can design good ships. It's just that most of the Kriegsmarine's arsenal in World War II either weren't particularly good ships, or if they were serviceable, they weren't particularly efficiently designed. Whereas if you look back to World War I, almost all of the Imperial German Navy designs have a lot of good qualities to say about them. As I said, you know, everything has flaws in it, but that applies even to the absolute best designs out there. Almirante Brown asks, why didn't the Japanese remove all the casement-mounted 6-inch guns on the Congo class during their final rebuild and replace them with half a dozen twin 5-inch dual-purpose guns? How much weight could the Japanese have saved by removing those casement guns and their related equipment, and what, in your opinion, would have been the best use of that saved weight? So the reasons for not replacing the entire 6-inch casement battery are quite varied when it comes to the Congos. One of the lesser issues you've got to remember is that the Congos get a series of refits over basically most of the 1930s if we're looking at the sort of the final refits, if you like. So Congo has a huge modernization at the beginning of the 30s, and then she has another one in the mid-1930s. And during most of that time period, although the Congos are theoretically available for escorting the Kido Butai, or the carriers, because the Kido Butai doesn't exist in the 30s, only comes into existence in the 40s, but you know, you get the point. The other big role for the Congos in Cantacuzene is to actually be the backstops of the surface attack forces that will hit the US fleet at night while it's theoretically doing its big transit over to the Western Pacific. And in that role, the heavier hitting 6-inch guns are actually more practical, because the dual-purpose nature of the 5-inch guns doesn't really make much benefit if you're attacking at night, because aircraft won't be operating at night, at least in the 30s, at which point you just want to hit the enemy with the heaviest shells possible, and the 6-inch casement guns still offer a good deal of that. And if you look through the refits, they're actually not just leaving the 6-inch guns in place, they're actually modifying and improving them and their mountings during those modifications. So they clearly see a battlefield role for them. Another issue is supply, because, of course, every twin 5-inch mount that you put on a capital ship is a twin 5-inch mount, isn't going on a destroyer. The Japanese don't have unlimited supplies of modern naval armament. That's more of a secondary issue, though. The other big problem, probably the single largest one from an engineering perspective, is the actual layout of the Congos. So if you look at the final iteration of the Congos, at least, you know, the ones that are still around by the middle of the Second World War, they have half a dozen twin 5-inch mounts, and their 6-inch battery has dropped by about half compared to what they had originally. But if you look at a top-down plan, the biggest problem is deck space. Where are you actually going to put these things? The casement guns, by being a level below and obviously in armored casements, they can and do, as you can probably see from this picture, sit directly adjacent to the main battery, and they can operate there. You can't put an open twin mount 5-inch right next to, let's say, X turret, the one that's pointing at us in this picture, because the minute that thing turns around, your gun crew are going to have to run for cover, and if they don't, they're going to get horribly injured, if not killed. And even if they do manage to run for cover, that 5-inch gun probably isn't going to be in the best shape, at least the mount isn't, after the guns have finished firing. And because the Congos have this very spaced out aft armament, where the super firing aft turret is almost a Q-mount position rather than an X-mount position, it means that the deck space either side of the superstructure and funnels between B-turret and, we'll call it for the sake of argument, X-turret, is somewhat reduced proportionally than it would be, than would be the deck space on a similar sized vessel that had a more conventional pair of super firing turrets, so an ABXY layout. And with that reduced amount of deck space, compounded by the fact, of course, that your super firing aft turret wants to be able to turn as far forward as possible, it basically means there's actually a relatively small area where you can actually put twin 5-inch mounts and still have them operational. So if you look again at a top-down view, you'll see that in theory you'd think you could fit at least a fourth either side twin 5-inch mount. But if you then think about where is that aft super firing turret going to be aiming if it swivels all the way around forwards as far as it can go, you suddenly realize that's directly in the blast zone. So they've got a very limited amount of space that they can put heavy dual-purpose artillery. They certainly by 42-43 have pretty much filled that area as best they can with the half dozen twin 5-inch. But at the end of the day, if you're still thinking quite seriously about potential surface secondary roles, anti-surface secondary roles, 6 5-inch guns, that's not a particularly fantastic secondary broadside. And so you need those other 6-inch guns to bring your secondary broadside's weight up to par. Now, of course, you could save quite a few hundred tons by deleting those 6-inch casemates, but that's still not going to solve the deck space issue. And honestly, the amount of weight saved, while I've pointed out consistently that the best way that the Congo class could have been upgraded would have been to have armor that was actually meaningful at any kind of significant battle range against other capital ships, just stripping out the 6-inch casement battery, I don't think is going to buy you anywhere near enough weight to actually do those upgrades. So as imperfect a solution as it is, if you're going to use twin fives, then the layout that you get is probably the most optimal you are going to get. Now, without reconstructing the ship massively to move the aft turrets to a slightly different position, I think probably the most concentrated battery you could get, you could potentially add another pair of twin fives on either side by creating a kind of stepped arrangement like you see on US fast battleships. So you'd have the two outboard 5-inch mounts, and then between them, where there's actually secondary rangefinders on the historic Congo, you could have another twin mount, and you'd move those rangefinders probably slightly further aft, more adjacent to the first funnel, deleting a couple of the ship's boats. And then you've got a kind of a platform deck adjacent to the bridge where historically, again, there's some triple 25 mils. Now you could either widen that or cut that down and put another twin five on there. That would then give you 10 5-inch guns either side. And you probably would have to sacrifice the majority, if not all of the remaining casement mounts in order to do that. Would see it theoretically, I would smooth the hull out a little bit as well, the way they did with Queen Elizabeth and Valiant. However, that's a very densely packed dual-purpose array, and critically, unlike the US layout, these twin 5-inch mounts are open, which means that those ones that essentially offset super-firing could have some fairly nasty blast effects on the ones below, which is probably a good chunk of the reason why they didn't actually do that. So to justify eliminating all of those 6-inch casemates, I think you'd either have to look into a really dense packed set of twin fives, so five twins per side, But you'd also have to look into the weight and stability implications of making them at least blast shielded, fully enclosed, if not fully enclosed with a little bit of armor. And on top of that, ideally, I mean, a lot of these refits are taking place, as I said, in the early to mid 1930s. But in an absolute ideal world, if you're going to pull them in for additional work in the mid, going on late 1930s, perhaps even the very start of the 40s, you might want to look, at least if you've got a little bit of future sight, into instead using the twin 100 mils that you find on the Akazukis, because they're smaller and more compact, so you can actually probably get five twins on either side at that point without the same level of overcrowding issues. And of course, they're a much, much better anti-aircraft weapon. The one big downside, which I suspect would be a major strike against that option from a Japanese perspective, is that while the twin fives are still somewhat respectable as anti-surface weapons, honestly, a battery of 3-inch guns doesn't give you a huge amount of anything in terms of secondary anti-surface capability, unless you're at very, very close range against something, at which point it's probably either launch torpedoes at you or you have other big problems to worry about. So, yeah, with future sight, maybe that would be a viable way of doing things. But honestly, at the time, I don't think there would be a justifiable reason. BK Zhong asks, which was the biggest logistical bottleneck for each World War II Navy? This is actually quite interesting because it varies not just by nation, but also by time period. So the simplest and easiest ones are probably the Italians and the French. Their single largest logistical bottlenecks when it comes to building and maintaining a fleet are shipyard capacity and money. Because if you want to build and supply a big fleet or larger ships, that means you have to, you know, have the shipyards to build the ships and the money to pay for those ships and the supplies that they're taking to the front lines, and they simply don't have that. So there is a natural cap to the size of those fleets that's actually pretty baked in to what they have at the start of the Second World War. With the Germans, they have a similar issue, except not so much the funding side. Germany can, theoretically at least, on paper, fund more ships than the Regia Marina or the Marine Nationale. The big limitations that Germany faces are in terms of infrastructure. Again, they've got some pretty darn big infrastructure, but it is a fraction of a fraction of what they had available to them when it was the Imperial German Navy in the run-up to World War I. And along with that massive downsizing of their shipbuilding industry comes a certain lack of expertise, partly just through a much smaller workforce, but partly also through the Versailles Treaty restrictions. So one of the bigger problems they have building the Graf Zeppelins, for example, they simply do not have any experience in building aircraft carriers, and suddenly they're being thrust into building a gigantic purpose-built aircraft carrier, whereas the other nations had a combination of small and or converted carriers to start playing with at first, like Hosho, Hermes, Argus, Langley, etc. You know, whereas essentially if you look at the displacement, at least, of the Graf Zeppelin, that's basically like Japan, the UK and the US, similarly, if they didn't have any expertise at all in building aircraft carriers, suddenly being asked to build an Essex, an Implacable, or a Shikaku. It's not surprising they had problems. For the British, by World War II, the two largest constraints they have in terms of being able to build a larger navy are gun production and, actually, ironically enough, the associated fire control equipment. Armor production is quite a big bottleneck going through the 30s, but they are improving on that. The ability to produce lots of guns, however, is lagging a little bit behind. That's in fact, a very large part of the reason why the Vanguard and her proposed successors were supposed to have twin 15s that had been refitted, because they already had them. And the ever-increasing complexity of the fire control systems was the other big problem, because, you know, back in the 20s, early 30s, a destroyer needed, for example, using a fairly small combatant, would need a rangefinder and fire control setup for anti-surface guns. Fantastic. By mid to late World War II, that same destroyer probably needs surface search radar, air search radar, gunnery control radar, potentially for both of those things, as long with optical rangefinders, possibly more than one, rangefinders and fire control equipment for its anti-aircraft, dedicated anti-aircraft guns, so things like Bofors and Oerlikons, and as well as an anti-aircraft fire control system for its main armament, as well as the surface fire control system, and so on and so on and so on. And that's just a destroyer, let alone a capital ship or a cruiser. And so while British shipyards, as it turns out, can actually churn out a spectacular number of destroyers, not quite as many as obviously the American shipyards can turn out, but when you look at the both the production rates and the production times, British yards aren't that far behind, certainly compared to what you might otherwise think. The big shutdowns that occur during the 30s primarily have actually affected the ability of the British naval industry to support the construction of big ships, cruisers, battleships, and aircraft carriers. The big hindrance is actually the production of these fire control systems. So significant numbers of destroyers, certainly in the mid to late part of World War II for the Royal Navy, are either on pause, or the orders aren't taken up, or the orders are cancelled, or the ships are launched and then sit in abeyance for a long time, because they don't have the fire control systems that they need to make their armament work properly. That's one of the reasons why the battle class, you only have Barfleur show up right at the very end of the war. Theoretically, quite a few of the battle class could have been with the British Pacific Fleet for a good chunk of its operational time in the Far East, but they're almost universally held back by a shortage of fire control equipment. And for the US, their two single largest bottlenecks in ship production are probably something everyone's anticipating, which is propulsion. You know, the production of geared turbines in particular. There's a reason you have diesel electric, turbo electric, all sorts of weird and wonderful propulsion systems being dreamt up for smaller ships. It's simply because the geared turbine production, despite the size of the US industry, physically can't keep up with the demand for every single US warship that wants to go reasonably quickly to have geared turbines, so they have to prioritize. The other big issue is steel, in actual fact. Not just, you know, simple slabs of steel, but the kind of steel you actually need to produce warships. That is also a production bottleneck. It's one of the reasons why the Alaska class, this is Guam, by the way, are so delayed, because the US's Navy is looking at things and going, well, we physically can't get enough steel of the requisite types from US industry, especially with all the other demands for steel from, you know, the Air Force and the Army, to build the number of ships we want. So we're going to have to prioritize. Some ships are going to have to wait, and we'd rather prioritize building more Essex class than the Alaskas in this particular case. And hence the delay there. And this passes out throughout the rest of the fleet. And there are other bottlenecks that they're approaching, but they don't quite hit. For example, actually, the US also has a shortage of fire control systems. When they're refitting the Pearl Harbor salvaged ships, for example, a good chunk of the refitted standards go out with cruiser-grade fire control systems, most of them taken off of the Cleveland-class hulls that were turned into Independence-class carriers, because that's the best that they can supply at short notice, because constructing the massive systems that you put on the Iowas and the South Dakotas and so forth, that's actually a bottleneck. But they can supply something that is good enough for the purpose by using a slightly smaller system. And this actually also shows when it comes to, ironically enough, the British, because when the British begin to hit their own bottleneck of fire control systems, they go, oh, hang on a minute, why don't we just order a bunch from the Americans? The Americans have lots of everything. And the US Navy actually turns around and says, look, I appreciate you need them, but so do we. And at this point, production is hitting a bottleneck such that if we send you everything you want, we won't have everything that we need. So, sorry, we're prioritizing ourselves, understandably. And therefore, the British production systems slow down. because they don't have access to the fire control equipment. But so the US can just about keep up with its own needs, but it's a very much approaching the edge there. Moshe Shaw asks, given the outpouring of responses to your autism dry dock answer, could you do a Friday video going through some of the historical documentation that you've seen? It's a really fascinating human side that a lot of people seem to be interested in. It's certainly something I could look at doing at some point. However, I would put a very big caveat on that. And that is, obviously, I am a naval historian, primarily looking at ships' tactics and technology. As I've said many times before, I am not a historian of humans, whatever that is. Whether, I don't know, is that a sociologist, an anthropologist, something else? I don't even know the correct term for it, let alone actually be one. And so there, I think if I was going to do something like that, basically a really deep dive into a general human interest element, especially something like autism in the time period the channel covers, I think I would have to call on the services of somebody who does actually specialize in that kind of field to help provide, you know, qualifiers and explanations and so forth. Because apart from anything else, of course, the diagnosis that we have today, whether that be autism, Asperger's, ADHD, OCD, or any number of other things, simply didn't exist back then. So it's not like a biography of an admiral or a captain where we can say, oh, this happened, he did this. There's a reasonable amount of data about this particular person and his personality and why he did this, that, or the other. This is more general, and it's not quite reading between the lines, because I always think if someone says, oh, we're reading between the lines, my immediate thought is, so you don't actually have any proof, you're kind of inferring everything. And that's not strictly the case. In this case, there is a degree of reading between the lines because we are inferring a diagnosis that they didn't have and therefore doesn't exist on paper. But what we do have is a lot of documented evidence about what they were doing. And then theoretically, someone can sit down and go, okay, well, according to our modern medical diagnosis techniques, if someone was exhibiting this behavior, but not this behavior, all of which is factually recorded, then we would say that they are probably this. So hopefully you can see why I might need someone who's actually an expert on that to, you know, for something like a dry dock answer, I can give you my opinion and point out the evidence. For something like a half hour, 45 minute Friday video, I would want to be perhaps a little more specific rather than, well, these people are clearly on the spectrum. I'd rather at that point have someone in who could go, okay, yeah, these are, but you know, this person was clearly far further along the spectrum, and this person had something different to that person in terms of neurological differences and so forth, and so on and so on and so forth. Because, yeah, there is actually quite a lot of interesting historical data for that kind of thing, but a lot of it is hidden away in what you might term personal remarks and comments and notes and things like that, which were kind of just passing observations to people back then, but for this particular purpose would be kind of the primary evidence that we have. You know, things like somebody writing a note about, well, you know, this boy has never been able to find work because nobody can get him to work properly, but you know, we brought him into our naval warehouse as a favor to his uncle, who happens to be my wife's brother or something or other. And it turns out, actually, as long as you leave him alone with a list of shelves to stock and things to inventory, he's actually really, really good. Just don't try and talk to him or make loud noises or have bright lights. Just like leave him alone to become the warehouse gremlin and he'll be as happy as ever. He just really doesn't deal well with people. And as I said in the dry dock answer, it's a weird juxtaposition in that they obviously have no clue what this condition is, from at least from a modern perspective. Obviously they're not diagnosing it as anything in particular, But on the other hand, there is a, having obviously dealt with a number of people in my own life who are treated very differently at the minute that you say, oh, this, either they say or someone else says, oh, this person has XYZ, and suddenly you can see potential employers and even acquaintances, people they've just met, immediately start to treat them very differently, and usually not in a particularly positive way. Whereas, yeah, as I say, back in those days, they didn't have the specific diagnosis, but they seemed to just accept that it's all part of God's creation. You know, everything is different. And again, the comparison isn't particularly flattering, but some, you will actually find some people at the time, sort of from the more professional bent of things, got literally writing things like, well, you know, we have multiple different kinds of dogs, multiple different kinds of cats, there's plenty of different types of fish in the sea, they all act differently. Well, clearly we're going to have different types of humans, and they're not all going to act the same way. Now, of course, these days, some people might take exception to being compared to a dog, a cat, or a fish. But you can kind of see what the point that they were getting across was, it's just different. Let's just get on with it. You know, they're not harming anyone by being particularly order obsessed, and we can actually put them to use for that. So as a result, this kind of, I guess you'd call it accepting of ignorance. They're kind of like, well, we don't know why this guy is like that. We can't do anything about it. And obviously then you get the negative side of, heaven knows we've tried. But then they're like, well, you know, this appears to be his slot in life. I guess he's doing that, and he's doing it weirdly well. Don't understand it, but hey, we pay him and we get good results, so why should we care any further about why exactly he's like this? Brendan Buersdorf asks, did the aircraft carriers have dedicated logistics vessels that just serviced them, like ships that could bring in spare parts or spare aircraft, or was it more typical for an aircraft carrier to just return to a major base or harbour instead? A bit of a mixture of the two, actually. So obviously here we've got Unicorn, probably the best example of a dedicated vessel for the support of aircraft carriers. But more broadly, and depending on time and Navy, these ratios will vary somewhat, but there would be three main ways that an aircraft carrier could be supported logistically, apart from the, you know, the standard refueling things. One, as you mentioned, is just go back to a major base. Now, this is quite good for a carrier that's got a very battered air wing or has been on prolonged operations, because you might need large numbers of new aircraft and to restock your spare parts, and the pilots might need a break. In fact, you might need to swap out an entire new air group. This is where things vary between navies, because sometimes, like with the US, quite quickly they adopt a process of, okay, this air group's really been through the ringer. Right, we're going to just move them wholesale ashore, or large part, and we're going to replace them with a whole other carrier air group, and then the carrier itself can go back out again quickly. The Royal Navy, for example, however, tended to just land the pilots, and unless you happen to have a fairly unusually large number of fleet air arm pilots and aircraft to hand, usually the carrier would wait while they had an extended break, during which time the carrier itself would often usually be refitted. So that's kind of your major option. At your kind of intermediate stage, you would have forward operating bases like Manus or Ulithi or Subic Bay or something like that, which would have stocks of engines, aircraft, spare parts, spare pilots even, and an aircraft carrier could fall back to there to replenish its air group without having to go all the way back to a major base. And you could also have escort carriers and the like who could pick up, you know, contingents from those forward bases and ferry them out to the carriers on the front line if the carrier's presence on the front line as a sustained force was necessary. And the third element of it was that you would also get dedicated what they would call aircraft repair ships or aircraft supply ships or variations on that theme, again, depending on the Navy. And these would be standard logistical support ships, you know, freighters, Liberty ships, Victory ships, pre-war freighters, whatever. But they would be stocked and kitted out specifically with aircraft engines, spare wings, tooling, various other spare parts, crated aircraft, guns and ammunition specifically for the aircraft. And when the carriers drop back to the forward operating bases, then those ships would be there to specifically supply the carriers. And occasionally you might find these ships sailing with the forward supply fleets to directly supply carriers as and where necessary. Redosaurus asks, did the US Navy ever consider launching carrier strikes against Tirpitz? And if not, why not? No, as far as I'm aware, the US Navy never seriously considered mounting carrier strikes against Tirpitz. And that's for, well, one very good reason, which you can see here. That's USS Ranger. Now, she does have Dauntlesses, and by the time that Tirpitz is seriously around in Norway, Avengers as well. So she could potentially have been a threat to Tirpitz. However, where Tirpitz is and where Ranger is available is kind of the make or break, because the US doesn't deploy any other big carriers to the Arctic area, the home fleet specifically, obviously the Royal Navy. So during the time period when Ranger is with the home fleet, Tirpitz, for the most part, is based right up in the very, very, very north of Norway. So, for example, when the X-craft attack her, she's in Karfjord, which, as I say, is basically, is in the bit of Norway that overlaps over the top of Sweden. Now, the reason why that's a problem for carrier strikes is, one, obviously it's much further north, so the weather's usually not particularly nice, but also it's further to go. It would involve taking ships much further into German-controlled waters and airspace, especially with threats like U-boats around. And during that time period as well, there is still quite a significant Luftwaffe strength for most of that time. It's one of the reasons why the X-craft are selected. After Tirpitz takes damage from the X-craft, and also at around that same time, you have a good chunk of the Norwegian-based Luftwaffe elements being called south to the Mediterranean to try and defend against the Allied invasions of Sicily and Italy, and also to Europe. So simultaneously, you have a diminishment of Luftwaffe air strength, and in order for her to be repaired, Tirpitz is moved further south to essentially the western coast of Norway. Now, at that point, you're talking early 1944, Tirpitz is therefore less well defended and easier to get at with carriers. But for poor old Ranger, she's been called back to service in the US and then in the Pacific at the end of 1943, beginning of 1944. So by the time Tirpitz is in a position where the US would consider sending Ranger after her, Ranger is no longer in theater. If Tirpitz had been moved south 6 months earlier, or Ranger had stuck around for 44, then I'm pretty sure you would see Ranger taking part in the carrier strikes against Tirpitz. But as it is, timing and location just worked against the idea. King of Tanks asks, I'm aware that between the Ironclad Age and World War II, there were massive improvements in gun technology, increasing the effectiveness of ships' guns with better propellant and advances in metallurgy and manufacturing that allowed for stronger breeches, longer barrels, higher pressures, and better shells. But it's unclear to me how drastic these were. Now, obviously, a Yamato or Iowa would comfortably beat anything built pre-World War I, but how far back would a Des Moines or a Baltimore need to go for their modern guns and armor to be effective against capital ships within the opponent capital ship's effective battle range? And what about the cruiser's effective battle range? Well, a cruiser's biggest advantage would be their own effective battle range, because when you look at, you know, even World War I itself, Battle of Jutland, range is opening in the high tens of thousands of yards, so 15 to 20,000 yards, and then dropping significantly below that. However, by World War II, even heavy cruisers would generally expect to be opening fire at somewhere between 20 and 23,000 yards. When you see clashes involving Italian heavy cruisers in the Mediterranean, for example, that's generally where ranges tend to be open. Now, there are rare cases, particularly in the Pacific, where gunfire is exchanged at longer ranges than that, but you'll tend to notice that accuracy is not all that brilliant. So even with that lower bracket, it still means that a heavy cruiser, especially a late war heavy cruiser like a Des Moines, or indeed a Baltimore, can comfortably engage at a range that is still 3,000-4,000 yards beyond what's considered quite long range at Jutland. And the further back you go, 1910, 1905, 1900, the effective battle range of the various ships is dropping quite quickly until you get to 1900 and it's, you know, 3,000 odd yards if you're lucky, at which point, yeah, the cruiser's biggest advantage at this stage is that not that its armor can withstand battleship gunfire, because even in 1900, 12-inch guns were still quite comfortably punched through the armor of a Des Moines or a Baltimore, but you're never going to hit the blasted things because they can move into, well, what for them is basically pea shooter range, 12,000 yards or so, and it's still going to be 3, 4, 5, 6 times further than the battleships can engage them at. Now, if you want to switch that around into armor penetration, as opposed to can hit at that range, so, you know, smash up the upper works, the fire control systems, etc., if you're going to go into wants to inflict body blows on your opponent, then things get a little bit more dicey. Because even with the Mark 21 super heavy AP shell that the Baltimores and the Des Moines are carrying, in a pure shell versus armor contest, even that late war 8-inch gun is still only penetrating 10, 11 inches of armor at 10,000 yards. And that means in a World War I context, the cruisers are still relatively vulnerable if they want to go for that. Now, obviously, as I said, they can just stand at range and smash up the upper works realistically if they wanted to. But if we were putting them in an artificial scenario of you must get close enough to punch holes in your enemy's citadel, in a World War I situation, a Baltimore or Des Moines would have to get to within about 50 to 60% of the battleship's effective battle range in order to start getting to a point where their guns could punch through the enemy armor belt. And that's not going to end well for them because they've got to cross 8,000 plus yards in a scenario where 12, 13.5, 14, 15 inch, 16 inch gunfire can very easily punch through their own armor. However, things start to change quite radically as you go immediately pre-World War I. So, for example, in, say, 1910, you would expect battle ranges to be maybe in the region of 9 to 11,000 yards, give or take a little bit, given who's fighting, which means that while the cruisers are still at a slight disadvantage, they're entering effective armor penetration range at about the same time, or just after, the battleships are entering their effective battle range. And that, of course, means that with the faster rate of fire of the 8-inch guns, there's a chance that they might start scoring hits considerably sooner. If you dial back to 1905 to, say, the Battle of Tsushima, now you're talking about pre-dreadnoughts, and not only are their effective battle ranges lesser still, so 6,000-7,000 yards, but their armor belts have now dropped quite considerably as well. So now you're in a position where those cruisers can start to punch through the battleship citadel at, let's say, about 15,000 yards against most period pre-dreadnoughts. Not all, but most. And the period pre-dreadnoughts only have an effective battle range of about half that. And obviously things get worse the further back in time you go. So if you want a situation where, by playing it cleverly, the cruiser can win, then theoretically a 1v1 with most World War I era capital ships, a late World War II era cruiser, heavy cruiser at least, could pull off, but it would be a keep away and shoot them until they can't reply because you've broken all their fire control systems, then close for the kill. Whereas if you want a situation of this cruiser can comfortably sit outside of the effective range of an enemy battleship and just punch holes in it straight through the citadel all day, you're probably looking at some point in the mid to late 1900s. Now, that's not to say that in the mid to late 1900s, the cruiser is safe from a 12-inch shell. It absolutely would not be if it got hit by one. But at that point, it's less about the effectiveness of the guns and more about can you actually aim them that far? Because, you know, then there's nothing wrong with the 12-inch gun you might find on Mikasa or Borodino or Dreadnought for dealing with a cruiser that's got 6 inches, maybe a fraction more belt armor. Those guns can and will reach out and smash through your armor, even at 15,000 yards. But they don't have the facilities to actually aim them at that distance in that time period. GFDX asks, are there any ship names where you would think, why would you even name a ship this? You know, something almost along the lines of HMS Sink Me. One of the funniest ones to me is HMS Decoy, seen here in her fourth iteration of 6 different ships in the Royal Navy that have been named to Decoy. But given the name, you might be surprised to learn that actually there's only been one of them lost to enemy action. And that was the very first ship of her name, which was a small cutter. And even then, she was only lost because she went aground in the fog, not because she just took on, you know, something bigger than she could chew. This particular iteration of Decoy is also the only other one to be lost rather than reach the end of her natural service life, although she was lost in a collision during night exercises, so that was kind of a friendly fire case. You've also got the old bomb vessel HMS Carcass, which, I mean, yeah, at the time it meant a kind of shot, but yeah, the idea of an HMS dead body is quite amusing. And you do wonder, who would volunteer to serve on a ship like Decoy or the dead body? The US, by and large, manages to avoid this by using state names, city names, and names of people, although you do occasionally get, I wouldn't necessarily say, why would you ever name this, but, you know, someone probably was having a bit of a laugh on that day, because you get, like, the famous destroyer escort USS England. You know, yes, the Americans are sailing around in a ship named England. As it turns out, obviously, it was named after a person whose surname was England, but still, it'd be like having an HMS United States. Vokia asks, in The Fleet at Flood Tide, Hornfisher contends that had Halsey been in command at the Battle of the Philippine Sea, then he may have placed the US fleet and landings at undue risk by meeting the Japanese head on. What's your opinion on this? And how much risk would the landings have been at had the US flat top succumbed to Mitch's suggestions to steam west? I think Halsey definitely would have been a lot more aggressive, and yes, that potentially could have gone rather badly wrong. Or at least, he probably still would have won, but it would have come at a greater cost to the US. And I think there's lots of different scenarios you could concoct, but there are two major ones which you could come up with where the US fleet takes a lot more damage. So the first one would be when you look at the various waves of attack. Obviously you have one of the latter waves actually overshoots, doesn't find anything, comes back and then launches an attack that does cause a little bit of damage, but not a huge amount. So if the US fleet steams west at relatively high speed, leaving the landings uncovered, assuming the Japanese don't change their tactics all that much anyway. And bear in mind, the Japanese were reasonably good at reading the overall intentions of US commanders, so they may actually go for a surface attack group hooking around if they know that Halsey's there. But assuming that they don't really change tactics all that much, it is possible or plausible that one of those Japanese attack groups overshoots the US fleet and ends up basically finding itself near the US landings and all the transport ships and so forth with relatively minimal cover for those ships, at which point obviously they would go in for an attack, and that could cause a fair amount of damage to the landings, especially obviously at a time when they're still trying to push inland quite significantly. So, you know, blown up troop transport, supply ships, and just the chaos of having to deal with that air attack, that would obviously be a much higher cost than historically the US had to pay. The other more kind of at sea situation would be that obviously historically the idea of having the battleships out as the first stop line and baiting the Japanese into attacking them worked quite well. If, however, Halsey and Mitcher sail west, then it's possible that the battleships might not be forming that ahead skirmish line. They may be arrayed in a more conventional escort formation around the carriers, but without that forward stop line, that would then mean that when the Japanese attacks arrive, and obviously if the US formation is generally speaking closing, then there's a slight decrease in time between spotting and engagement, but that's not really the main point. The main point is that when those Japanese attacks arrive, if they see a formation of carriers with associated escorts, then much as they did historically when they actually finally spotted the carriers, they go for the carriers. And obviously there were bomb drops and torpedo drops and everything which came close to inflicting damage or did inflict damage on the various US ships. And so if instead of going after the battleships and expending all their energy there, the first waves go after the carriers and then continue to go after the carriers, then it is entirely possible that one or more bombs, torpedoes, or crashing aircraft find their mark on the US carriers, which are, of course, far more vulnerable to damage than the battleships, and that could obviously therefore cause a lot of problems. Now, as I said, that's not necessarily going to win the battle for the Japanese, especially since the US submarines are completely independent of what Halsey and Mitch are doing, and so they're probably going to take Taiho and Shikaku anyway, but it could overall lead to a lot of additional unnecessary casualties for the US fleet. Sebastian asks, if Admiral Yamamoto wasn't killed by P-38s in 1943, would the Pacific War have gone any differently, and could he have changed the outcome at all? Overall outcome, no, and no one man, however brilliant, at that point is going to reverse the fortunes of Japan. However, I think he probably could have played the cards that the Japanese Navy was being dealt at that point a little bit better than they historically did. I mean, Admiral Yamamoto was a pretty good admiral. I mean, he made mistakes, obviously, but a number of his plans were fairly well thought out. Also, although obviously he did have his star diminished somewhat by the loss at Midway, he was still a very senior officer. He still had a fair degree of political clout, and therefore he had a bit more ability to not countermand, but to push back against some of the more, shall we say, interesting suggestions from Japanese Navy High Command and the government. So I think some of the more disastrous choices that the Japanese Navy took in the years after his death, maybe he could have avoided, and maybe therefore retained the strength of the Japanese Navy a little longer than it historically did last. So, for example, I'm fairly sure that the habit that the Japanese Navy developed of building up carrier air groups, getting them somewhat trained, and then just sending them off wholesale to land-based airfields to fight and die in a half-trained manner, and then rebuilding the carrier air groups from scratch again with green pilots, I'm pretty sure he would have heavily resisted that and advocated for, no, we need the carrier air groups to be as experienced as they can be, and if we need aircraft on land, then we'll draw them from other sources, which would have improved the Japanese carrier air arms, capacity for action, at least as long as there was a Japanese carrier air arm worth mentioning. So overall, I think if he remained alive, he probably would have increased the overall effectiveness of the Japanese Navy in its resistance, but that would have been more seen just in the case of these battles occur, the Japanese perhaps take slightly fewer losses, the Americans take slightly more losses maybe, but it's probably still going to go, broadly speaking, the same way. The Rogue Chief asks, after Operations Verserubung and Barbarossa, Allied diplomatic missions in Sweden effectively became isolated. How are these missions kept sustained, especially with regard to material supplies or rotating personnel? And do you have any good resource recommendations for the Swedish Navy and coastal defence system during the World War I and World War II period? So with regards to good books and resources on the Swedish Navy and its coast defence system during the World Wars, unfortunately, there's not a huge amount in English, but if you drop me an email, there are some fairly good books in Swedish that I picked up when I was on my Scandinavian tour, and I can, point you in the direction of those books if you are able to get them translated, or extracts from those books. I could maybe give it a go translating myself. For example, there's a two-volume set called, and apologies to the Swedish because I'm probably going to horribly mispronounce this, Varmarin 500R, which I think is basically the Swedish Navy 500 years of history. Volume 1 is 1522 to 1899, but then Volume 2, which is almost as thick, is 1900 to 2022. So obviously a good chunk of that covers the World War I, World War II period. Now, with regards to the diplomatic missions in Sweden, the simple solution was just you leave them there. You don't rotate personnel. So the British ambassador to Sweden was exactly the same person. You can see him here talking to the Swedish foreign minister between 1939 and 1945. And similarly, the US ambassador to Sweden took up their post at the end of 1941 and just stayed there till 1945. So, yeah, you don't rotate the personnel. You just leave them in place. And as far as material supplies are concerned, small but critical diplomatic supplies could still be sent to Sweden because it was a neutral country, so it could sail ships to and from its ports. But broadly speaking, in terms of basic material supplies, food, housing, stationery, etc., that stuff would just be bought locally because you could still wire money. So that was certainly a thing. So yeah, basically just turtle up and wait for the war to end. Nick Brodar asks, had the Italians possessed sufficient fuel and willpower, could the Regia Marina seriously contest or even thwart Operation Husky? So Operation Husky is July-August 1943, the landings in Sicily. So let's take a look at what the Allies put up and what the Italians potentially, if they'd had the fuel, could have put up to counter them. So the primary Allied covering force consisted of six battleships and two carriers, the Indomitable, Formidable, Nelson, Rodney, Warspite, Valiant, King George V, and Howe, obviously with cruisers and destroyers and so forth. Now, against that, the Italians don't really have all that much to go on. All three Littorios have been damaged to one extent or another by Allied bombing raids in the immediate run-up to Husky, specifically to prevent them from doing something like this. Vittorio Veneto is the most badly damaged. He's definitely not available. Littorio and Roma possibly could be made available, but at much reduced operational capability. Andrea Doria and Duilio are theoretically available. They're obviously historically drained of fuel because there isn't enough fuel, but if there was enough fuel, then physically they would be available, albeit obviously the crews would be a little bit out of practice. Giulia Cesare has been turned into a training vessel, but in theory is still there. And Conte di Cavour is still undergoing repairs after Taranto. So if you magically provided everyone with enough fuel, you'd have, in theory, the three older, modernized dreadnoughts, which would be available, operational, but with somewhat, you know, untrained, not necessarily untrained crews, but crews who hadn't been to sea for a while. And you could maybe get Roma going without its aft turret, and maybe Littorio, but it'd be questionable. So I say, to be safe, you could get four battleships out, one of which would include one of the Littorios, albeit damaged, and three of the modernized pre-dreadnoughts, not pre-dreadnoughts, modernized dreadnoughts. So you've got four battleships, only one of which is new, up against six battleships, two of which are new and two of which are also heavy hitters, and another one is Warspite and Valiant's been heavily modernized, and two carriers and everything else. So, I mean, it wouldn't be a easy battle because four battleships are still four battleships, maybe five if you're lucky, but it's definitely not going to thwart Operation Husky, although it might be a fairly spectacular showdown. Alex Moskowitz asks, if 20th century naval engineers in the period the channel covers had had access to modern engineering tools such as FEA and CFD, where would we see the biggest improvements? So CFD is computational fluid dynamics and FEA is finite element analysis. So they're software tools for obviously structural calculations and fluid mechanics. So if they'd had access to those and presumably the computers to run them, then the biggest improvements I think you'd see would probably actually be more in terms of speed of design, because obviously design could be sketched up, but then once you had a design in place, you would have to get someone to manually calculate the various stresses and strains and so forth. If you've got a computer program where you can model the ship and then plug those figures in theory, as long as you can get people modeling the ship faster than you can get people doing the manual calculations, then your design process has become a lot shorter, which is obviously quite good. And in theory, as long as you put all the details in correctly, you'll pick up on some of the issues. So, you know, most of the time they get it right historically, but occasionally you do get things like obviously misplaced stability calculations or stress points and fractures are building up because someone's miscalculated something somewhere. In theory, again, assuming you put the right information in the first place, a fully computerized way of doing it not only will be faster, but also catch those issues. So you get a fewer structural issues with various ships. And with computational fluid dynamics, again, it's going to dramatically accelerate the rate at which you can actually do your, you know, hull form design and so on and so forth. It will probably lead to a slight increase in efficiency of ships flowing, going through the water. It might catch things like the vibration issues on the North Carolinas. But broadly speaking, both of these fields at the time are fairly well refined. It's just that obviously having to do everything manually, the calculations occur somewhat more slowly and have to be done on a slightly, if you like, macro scale as compared to a modern computer simulation, which can do everything down to the very, very tiniest changes. So I think you'd see three broad changes. The smallest would probably be in the overall efficiency, because you do need a fair amount of safety margin in warship design. So while ship design, you might get slightly lighter ships, slightly faster ships, etc., I don't think that change would be massive as compared to the bigger changes, which would be, one, you're catching some of the more obvious mistakes that we consistently hear about before they happen, with any luck, and also just the whole process would become somewhat faster. So if you need to design a ship, maybe shave several months off the actual design period, thus ships can be ordered and laid down faster and theoretically come into service faster. And that brings us to an end for this week's video. Thank you very much for listening, everybody, and I hope to see you in another video sometime soon.